Robert Larson here from the Lahontan Regional Water Board to speak on the Lake Tahoe TMDL and Lake Clarity Building Program.
Thank you, and as Dr. Horn and Bob Larson are coming to the podium, I just wanted to put the context for this agenda item. As our board knows, the North Coast region has in existence or in development a couple examples of water quality credit trading programs, as the Klamath River Tracking and Accounting Program, and then the Laguna de Santa Rosa Water Quality Credit Trading Program. And board member Corbett suggested that we also hear from the Lahontan Regional Board on an example, another example of credit trading programs, and for Lake Tahoe. So we're very pleased to have Dr. Amy Horn, who's a board member of the Lahontan Regional Board, and senior environmental scientist Bob Larson to address us today. Thank you so much for being here.
And I did want to, one preliminary question. Are you sufficiently rested from your stay at the
late
morning breakfast?
Well, briefly, yes.
We extend our thanks to staff. It's a fantastic evening, absolutely.
Yes. So, greetings to everyone, and it's nice to see board members again. Thank you very much for giving us the opportunity to come and address you today. I would like to make a quick response on the SEP program. I hope Mr. Kerrigan will talk about the program that we have in the Lahontan region. One of the things that we've done to deal with the issue of the burden on staff is we've formed agreements with third parties that we trust and have a strong track record, both financially and of getting projects done. And so we delegate a lot of the responsibility for tracking these SEP projects to them. And staff loves this because it takes the burden off them. So that's worked out really well in our region. So turning now to Lake Tahoe and the program we have there. So the Lake Tahoe TMDL is a science-based plan to restore Lake Tahoe's clarity. This has been a very long journey for us. I will give you some context and then hand the rest of the presentation over to Mr. Larson, who will give you the important information. Now I can't see my notes.
Okay, well, we can see your slides.
Is there some...
Can you turn the ones on over the board, Dias?
Most of the time I can do this without my notes,
but
okay, I will suffer. So the Lake Tahoe TMDL was a long process. I'll take that. It was divided into three phases. The first phase was the science phase, which began in 1959. Which we were trying to answer the questions of what pollutants are causing the clarity loss, how much of each pollutant reaches the lake, and how much of each pollutant can the lake receive and still meet the clarity goal. Stage two was the regulatory strategy phase, which is a quick, you're excellent, thank you. We can give this back to Matt now.
If I can find it.
The regulatory strategy phase, which was an intense five-year period during which we were trying to figure out what strategy we should use to reduce the pollutant loading, and secondly, how do we regulate the pollutant load reduction. And the third phase is where we are now, the implementation phase, which will go on, began in 2020 when we adopted the TMDL, 2010, I'm sorry. When we adopted the TMDL, and is going to go on for a long time, where we're trying to answer two questions, which are we achieving the expected reductions in pollutant loading, and is lake clarity improving? The science phase began in 1959. Dr. Charles Goldman began monitoring the lake clarity. the Squaw Valley Olympics were coming to Lake Tahoe, and development was ramping up, and so he began monitoring Lake Clarity, and his belief then was that the clarity he measured, thank you, was basically the natural clarity, that the lake basically had recovered from the abuses of the Comstock era and the extensive logging that took place in the Tahoe Basin. And his initial hypothesis, and then short, with the development that began at the around the time of the Squaw Valley Olympics, Lake Clarity began to decline rapidly. And Dr. Goldman's hypothesis, based on the best science of the time, was that the cause of the loss of clarity was nitrogen and phosphorus pollutants reaching the lake. And largely as a result of his lobbying activities, by 1968, all of the wastewater was exported from the Tahoe Basin. So unlike the issues you deal with right down here, we got rid of the POTWs and basically sent it to Nevada and places outside the basin. And from then on, all of the nitrogen and phosphorus entering the lake come from non-point sources. Activity began. I mean, there was lots of activity going on after 1968. Lots of BMPs installed, lots of policies passed, regulations made, and Lake Clarity continued to decline. Then in 1996, President Clinton and Vice President Gore came to Lake Tahoe. There was a Tahoe summit, which brought a lot of focus to Lake Tahoe, and the result was that we benefited from a lot of resources that came to the Tahoe Basin after that. Shortly thereafter that, the Lahontan Board contracted with Tetra Tech to develop a watershed model for the Tahoe Basin. And this was really the most intense period of the science phase. And so Tetra Tech adapted their watershed model to the Tahoe Basin, incorporated the 30 to 40 years of data we had on the 63 tributaries entering Lake Tahoe, the water quality and flow of all those tributaries. We adapted it, did an intensive study on stormwater and literature review, got parameters out of literature reviews of BMPs. They summarized this information for the entire Lake Tahoe Basin, so it was the first time we got a comprehensive view of what was going on with Lake Tahoe, and they divided it into six different categories of sources, whether the pollutants were coming from the atmosphere, from groundwater, from shoreline erosion, from stream channel erosion, from the urban areas, or from the non-urban or forested uplands. And then in 2005, we had a surprise, which is, there's a third pollutant we need to be paying attention to, which is fine sediment particles. These are defined as clay-sized particles and the smaller sizes of silt size, so anything less than 16 micrometers in diameter, the smallest stuff. So with the nitrogen and phosphorus, the issue there is that it promotes algae growth, and the algae absorbs light, and that was causing the loss of clarity. The opposite thing is going on with the fine sediment particles. They refract light, and that was causing the loss of clarity. So with the watershed model, we were finally able to get an answer to those second two questions on the science phase, which are how much of each pollutant reaches the lake, and how much of each pollutant can the lake receive and still meet the clarity goal. And next one. So what are the sources of nitrogen? Well, it turned out that 55% of the nitrogen comes from the atmospheric deposition. That's mostly from mobile sources, which is under the authority of the Air Board, so it's not Lahontan's problem. And then surprisingly, there was a feeling before we had this comprehensive view that shoreline erosion and stream channel erosion were important. You can see it. It looks important, as an important source of the pollutants. But when we got the comprehensive view, it turned out those were minimal for nitrogen. And then the other three categories, groundwater, urban uplands, and non-urban uplands, in terms of nitrogen, were about equal share. Next slide. And then when it comes to phosphorus, if you add the urban upland and the non-urban upland together, they account for about two-thirds of the phosphorus entering the lake. The urban area, even though that's smaller in terms of acres in the Tahoe Basin, is actually responsible for a larger share. And again, shoreline erosion and stream channel erosion turned out not to be very important. Next slide. And this was the big wow, that urban uplands were contributing 72% of the fine sediment particles. Again, stream channel and shoreline erosion turned out not to be that important. So, next slide. The conclusion of the science phase was that two-thirds of the clarity loss was caused by these fine sediment particles. And the total load reaching the lake was a huge number, 481 times 10 to the 16th particles entered the lake on an annual basis. And that in order to reduce, to reverse the clarity loss, we needed to reduce fine sediment particles by almost a third. And that the urban portions of the Tahoe Basin account for 72% of those fine sediment particles. And with that, I'll let Bob Larson take away the rest of the presentation.
Good morning, and thanks again for the opportunity to be here today. I just want to emphasize a couple points on this slide because I'll come back to these a couple times here. So again, Dr. Horn talked a bit about the differences between algal particles and fine sediment particles. Again, the fine sediment particles are having a disproportionate impact on clarity. That was really one of the big aha moments from our TMDL effort. And again, not only are they having a disproportionate amount effect on clarity, but the bulk of them, not surprisingly, coming from the urbanized areas. So once we completed that initial effort on evaluating sort of sources and magnitudes of pollutants reaching Lake Tahoe, we turned our attention to this question of what do we do about it, and also importantly, how do we incorporate the solutions into our regulatory program? So we undertook a project known as the Pollutant Reduction Opportunity Project, and within that effort, we reached out to the Water Board and NDEP. Reached out to regional, local, and in some cases national experts to give us a better understanding of what our opportunities were within those major pollutant sources for actually reducing the fine sediment particles and nutrients reaching Lake Tahoe. So they actually quantified those values and provided us some sense of cost associated with those different opportunities. So we took that information, looked at the cost effectiveness, and also looked to some degree about the feasibility. What can we actually do within these areas to really inform our overall implementation plan? So what this slide gives us is kind of a window into where we landed with our overall implementation approach. So this is the fine sediment particle load reduction and targets associated with the major sources. On the y-axis there, you can see the number of particles. Again, we actually count those fine sediment particles within the lake. There are these massive numbers in scientific notation. And then the major sources on the x-axis. And the purple bars or blue bars representing the baseline load as of 2004. And then the darker bars are representing the needed load reduction to accomplish our initial target within the first 15 to 20 year implementation phase. So what you can see here is that, again, not surprisingly, the urbanized area, as Dr. Korn mentioned, is the overwhelming source of those particles. And so again, it's not surprising that our opportunities for improvement and our opportunities to reduce those loads also lie within the urbanized area. For me, the big take-home message from this chart is really that we can't effectively achieve our goals or reduce pollutants or the fine sediment particles reaching Lake Tahoe unless we deal with the urbanized area. If you look at atmosphere, forest, streams, there are some, you know, there's loading there and there are opportunities for reduction. But again, the big ticket is with what's happening within the urbanized area. Confirmed by the red circle. So, and I want to stress the point, this point again about timeline. We talk a lot about our 15 to 20 year implementation phase. This is kind of what's considered in our mind a reasonable planning horizon. This is what we can look at too. But if you look at the actual timeline of the TMDL itself, it actually requires a 65% reduction in the fine sediment particles coming from urbanized area over the course of 65 years. So we're in this for the long haul. We're definitely looking in the long term in terms of achieving our goals. But again, I want to focus on that first time frame in terms of what we can do right now. So again, the bulk of the sediment particles coming from urban, the bulk of our opportunities also with the urban. Fortunately, on the California side of the Tahoe Basin, the California Water Board has an established Phase 1 municipal MPDES stormwater permit that regulates runoff on the California side of the Lake Tahoe Basin. And that permit was amended shortly after the TMDL was adopted to include performance-based standards that are consistent with the TMDL itself. And specifically what that does is it requires the municipalities to reduce their loads as percent reductions from that 2004 baseline that I referenced earlier. The time step and how we assess progress is on an average annual basis. Again, stormwater being a non-point source doesn't lend itself to day-to-day measurement per se due to the variation in storm systems and seasonal variation. So looking at average annual conditions is consistent with what we did for the TMDL. And again, I want to stress that we're looking at fine sediment particles, but those actions that are taken to reduce fine sediment particles are also effective generally at reducing nutrients, particularly phosphorus. Recall those charts that Dr. Horn brought up. A lot of the phosphorus coming from urbanized areas, and a lot of that phosphorus is linked with the fine sediment particles. So again, focusing on the FSP, but the nutrients are coming along for the ride. Our municipal stormwater permit in Lake Tahoe is one of the few in the nation that's actually a watershed-based permit. Our three co-permittees are Placer County, El Dorado County, and the City of South Lake Tahoe. You can see the City of South Lake Tahoe there on the south end of the lake. Their entire jurisdiction is within the watershed, and then the permit regulates the portions of the two counties that fall within the Lake Tahoe Basin. And the last one here is Caltrans. They're not a party to our municipal permit. I'm sure as you're aware, there's a statewide permit regulating runoff from Caltrans properties. The timing worked out really well where we were able to actually incorporate region-specific requirements into the last round of that Caltrans permit update, to essentially establish requirements consistent with what we're doing in the municipal permit. So that kind of covers our regulatory action, right? We've been able to sort of identify the sources, figure out what our options are, and kind of start to bake things into our regulatory structure in terms of requirements. I want to talk a bit now about the implementation phase, and that's really where a lot of the challenges lie. As we started to look forward as to how we're going to accomplish these goals, it was clear that we needed a very defined method for us to link what happens on the ground, our management actions to those expected water quality benefits. How are we going to track progress, not only at project scale, but across municipal scales and basin-wide scales to be able to assess not only compliance with the permit, but overall progress in meeting our TMDL goals. And the last point here, we want to make sure that we're removing any barriers for jurisdictions to cooperate. And so again, these just kind of lay out some of the challenges within our system and where we are looking forward for implementation. And so this brings us finally to the Lake Clarity Crediting Program itself, right? As we were developing the TMDL, US EPA awarded us a grant to evaluate water quality training opportunities at Lake Tahoe. And as we started to look at it, it became abundantly clear that before we could consider trading, before we could consider any type of broader programmatic approach, we needed a standardized metric of benefit. Again, I talked about the scientific notation, the number of particles. Those values are pretty cumbersome and not particularly meaningful to a lot of people. So we wanted a metric that was a little bit more approachable and a little bit more consistent. So we developed what we call the Lake Clarity Credit. The Lake Clarity Credit actually incorporates all three pollutants. Right now, the multipliers for nutrients are shut off, essentially, because fine sediment particles is our primary pollutant of concern. But the system itself does allow us to, in the future, incorporate additional pollutants into the system. So we have a single metric that incorporates our overall pollutants of concern. So we were able to incorporate that concept, that program, the Lake Clarity Credit, into our regulatory structure immediately. We were able to do so by multiplying the load reduction amounts set by the TMDL by jurisdiction-specific baseline values. And that gave us numeric targets for compliance and load reduction, again, consistent with the TMDL. So what this chart shows are the targets for 2016 and 21 and 2021. Our 2016 compliance date actually just passed. You can see by the helpful red check marks here that we've met those goals. We were able to assess that each jurisdiction has indeed accomplished and documented the number of credits as required by the permit. And what those values represent is a 10% reduction in fine sediment particles for each one of those jurisdictions. And then the second column there is looking forward to our next five-year permit term. Our water board adopted a renewed permit in March of this year, and that sets the next path forward for the next five-year permit term and sets those next targets for compliance. So the Lake Clarity Crediting Program is defined by three steps, essentially. The first of those is to establish what we call credit potential. And this is done using a standardized numeric model, and that model is used, again, at a number of different scales, but if you take an area and evaluate the conditions under baseline, our 2004 baseline conditions, and then compare that estimate with a separate estimate of what the loading would be following management actions, you can see what the water quality improvement might be. The delta between that baseline estimate and our expected estimate sets what we call the credit potential. Okay, so that allows us to, again, set what we think the water quality benefit would be. And that's documented in what we call a credit schedule, so it's just a form that we use to document that possibility. So credit award is not guaranteed, and this brings us to the next step. So just because the model says that water quality benefit will happen doesn't mean that it will. And so that's why it is critical that we have a verification step to look at what's actually happening in the field and compare that to our expected conditions. And again, that's that step two here where we're determining ongoing compliance by a set of field inspection practices that compare the conditions of best management practices and roadways to the model variables to make sure that things are aligned. And finally, our program is not static. The third and arguably the most important leg of this stool is an adaptive management program. And that adaptive management program allows us to regularly report results, see how we're doing, and also provides us with a clear and transparent way to make program improvements moving into the future. So one of the great strengths of our program is there are a number of different ways to get credit. Our model tools don't only look at credit from traditional stormwater practices such as curb and gutters and treatment basins, but it also looks at the benefit associated with improved maintenance practices on roadways, actually picking up the traction abrasives that are applied to the road and changing the amount of pollutant potential associated with roads. This is a very big deal in the mountainous environment. We apply on the order of anywhere from 10 to 15 tons of traction abrasive a year to the roadways. You can imagine the number of cars driving over those abrasives, pulverizing those abrasives, turning them into those fantastic fine sediment particles that are apparent clarity. So the change in the roadways is a big deal, and our tool wanted to make sure we accounted for that. The other thing we're highlighting here is private properties. There's a mandate in Lake Tahoe for all private property owners to control the runoff from their properties. This is implemented by the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency. And so there's an existing program in place, and we wanted our jurisdiction partners to be able to essentially acknowledge and take advantage of the benefit associated with the work that happens on private properties. Again, looking at how the program is implemented, the municipality uses our program in ways that they haven't, to prioritize what they do in ways that they didn't have before. We have planning tools at this point that allow them to look at different options and different alternatives and weigh those alternative approaches against each other to see what benefits them most. What this really does is put the jurisdiction in the driver's seat, allows them to make some decisions as to how best to improve water quality. The system focuses on areas that are directly connected to surface waters. Again, not all catchments, not all areas are created equal. Some areas are closer to the river or closer to the lake. So the system is actually set up to award more credit and more benefit for those areas that actually have a greater improvement in water quality. So the point here being is this: the prioritization process helps us guide our limited resources and helps our jurisdiction partners get the biggest bang for their buck. And again, the last point, as I mentioned, there's a verification process. You absolutely have to maintain and document that things are working before you actually get benefit. And this has really shifted the culture of maintenance in the basin. There's been a lot of public investment in stormwater infrastructure over the last 30 years, and a lot of it hasn't been maintained, frankly. And because the public dollars come in to build it, there are no money out there to maintain it. And this is a problem I'm sure you see and this is a problem statewide, not only nationwide, but our system is really set up to make sure that the maintenance occurs so we can see the benefit is happening. So to illustrate this and drive this point home one more time, if you take a generic urban area or an urbanized catchment, there are these three different mechanisms for getting water quality improvements. You can treat stormwater by constructing different infrastructure and hardscape on the ground to treat water. And then there are source control measures, such as these private property best management practices and other things that improve or encourage improvement in water quality. And then there's the roadway operations, again, what we talked about with traction braces and whatnot. And this is really the realm of our pollutant load reduction model. The pollutant load reduction model gives us the tool to evaluate the baseline as well as the expected conditions from these different actions. The verification step, again, you have to maintain those BMPs, you have to make sure that things are happening on private BMPs, as they said, and you need to do the work on the roadways. And that's where we have rapid assessment methodologies that provide us those standardized inspection practices to make sure that things are happening. Overlaying all of this is a piece of accounting and tracking software. And this is basically a user interface where folks engage with the program to document what they're doing and how things are actually functioning on the ground, and allows us also to verify, track, and otherwise account for the credits themselves. And so this is just a screenshot of that software. I'm very proud of the software right now, mainly because of where we've been with software and where we are now. We have made a great deal of improvements with our system, and this is a screenshot of our launch pad. And this really is a very integrated system that allows a single point of online contact for our system that allows all the users access. It allows them to inventory their modeled catchments, the treatment BMPs, the segments of roadway that they're expecting to improve, links that with the inspection practices and the assessment tab, and then again, there's a credit tab that allows us to sort of do the accounting and tracking of values themselves. It hasn't always been this way, is all I can say. and we're working right now, actually, on the software improvements. So it has been really gratifying to see this, and our partnership really enthused as well. I did mention this idea of credit sharing and making sure that we can work across jurisdictional boundaries. I think, as you're all aware, stormwater and runoff doesn't necessarily always obey municipal boundaries. And we wanted to make sure that we encourage and otherwise support watershed-based solutions for treating stormwater in the Tahoe Basin. Our poster child for this right now is a project within the Bijou area, the Bijou Erosion Control Project. You can see an image here. It's right on the lake, more or less. It's a very densely developed commercial area bisected by Highway 50, Lake Tahoe Boulevard there that you see. There's private property. There are city roadways. So we have a broad mix of land uses and jurisdictions and interested properties within that area. And this innovative project actually collects runoff from the entire area that you see there in a series of large vaults and pumps that stormwater more than a mile up into the watershed where it is treated by large detention basins before filtering out into the meadow. it sounds fantastic, right? The big ticket item here is $15 million. Right? This was not a cheap solution, but we were able to accomplish this goal by a public-private partnership in terms of funding. It costs a lot of money to maintain it as well. And again, by working together and providing that watershed-based solution, we're actually able to leverage public dollars to get private investment to make this happen. And so again, this is an opportunity that we don't see often, and we wanted our system to be able to support this thing. Both the City of South Lake Tahoe and Caltrans claim Lake Clarity credit from this project is actually a substantive amount of their compliance for that first permit term comes from this project, both Caltrans. So just a few more slides here in terms of how we're doing and how the program is working for us. From a water board perspective, it's great. We love it. And this is because it focuses our jurisdictions. As I mentioned, it allows them to prioritize what they're doing, and we can actually see what's happening. I think most importantly, it allows us to be able to link what they're doing, link the projects, link the maintenance actions, link their changes in roadways to the expected water quality benefit. We're able to actually use that to track our TMDL compliance. So it provides us a very nice connection to across our policy. Our municipalities, after some initial growing pains, I would be lying to you if I told you they loved it the entire time. But at this point, they do. It has taken some time to get to that point. But the municipalities at this point are very appreciative and actually have grown to appreciate this program for a number of reasons. Of course, they like the opportunity to partner and work together. They certainly like the flexibility But you know, what was really important to them is the predictability. We're able to set these numeric targets. The expectation of compliance is very clear to them. It is a number. It is something that they know, that they, and they know the game. They know the system. And so that type of predictability and consistency is extraordinarily valuable to them. And again, they appreciate the opportunity to achieve that goal in a manner that suits their needs and their jurisdictional specific details, as opposed to having a prescriptive approach. So they've come to very much appreciate that. Funding agencies are starting to use this too, not particularly the crediting program more holistically, but certainly the tools that we use to evaluate progress. As you can imagine, quantitatively assessing project benefit has great value when you're making funding decisions. So if you're the California Tahoe Conservancy, Forest Service, or other funding partners, are starting to use that tool to, again, make sure that their investment has the greatest benefit on water quality in relationship to their other goals, whether it be habitat restoration or other things. Looking at stakeholders, most folks in the basin support this, whether it be our environmental partners, the League to Save Lake Tahoe, the Sierra Club in general, we have broad support. There are some parties in the basin that still distrust models, and I think we will see this for some time, right? Models are scary, they're uncertain. There are a lot of things unknown about models and their disconnection to reality. So we continue to educate and work with people who have that skepticism, and we've certainly made some progress in the years past. The TMDL itself is entirely model-based, right? We have a watershed model, we have a clarity model. It makes sense that this all fits, but again, there's some distrust of that. There's also some concern out there about equity. You know, there are some parties that are very concerned about forest practices and what happens on the undeveloped landscape, as well as stream restoration projects. They see a very detailed and specific program for stormwater, and they don't see that same level of rigor for forests and streams and have some concerns about that. Again, if I go back to those bars, right, for us it makes a lot of sense. If we're going to spend time and money, hit it where it matters most. But again, some folks would like to see that, you know, they see an opportunity for that specificity, and it may come in the future. Just a few comments on lessons learned here in terms of things that we learned along the way and hopefully may provide some value to this board and your staff in terms of looking forward. Models and assessment tools are not cheap, and they're complicated, and it's best if you can develop those tools in concert with your policy. We didn't do that. I'll be very honest. We co-opted a number of different things that were developed by different parties for different purposes and incorporated them into our program. And that cost us years and millions, frankly. It cost us a lot of time and money because we had to reiterate and we had to integrate and we had to make sure that those tools ultimately fit with our policy. And so it delayed some adoption. So, you know, if you have the opportunity, if you have the flexibility, if you have the ability to make sure that those things are happening in concert, you can probably save yourself some time and energy. Along those lines is consistency and predictability. Dr. Horn has heard me pound on this for a number of years. Consistency and predictability in the program is the foundation. If folks have concerns that you're going to pull the rug out from underneath them or that the system is going to change, they won't play. And as we were changing the tools, as we were changing the model, as we were making these adjustments that I just referenced, the system ground to a halt. Nobody would engage because that predictability was not there. So wherever possible, we need to provide stability in these systems so folks know where the future's going. Along those same lines is sharing the risks associated with uncertainty. This point is really related to models. You know, the famous quote is, all models are wrong, so models are useful, right? And so, and that is absolutely true. The models are wrong and they will change. And it's important that we share the reality of that uncertainty with the partners who are working with us. Our system allows folks to register credits in a time frame ranging from 5 to 15 years, and that provides that stability. So if the model changes within the 6th, 7th, 8th, 10th year of a registration, we're not going to change the credit. We agreed that that's good for 10 years. And we'll absolutely revisit it at the 10th year, but we're sharing the uncertainty by awarding the credit based on what we know now. Again, all these points are kind of related, but updating the tools and software, again, things are going to change. Things will continually evolve. And so it's absolutely important to take advantage of that. And this is where the last point runs into this entire list of items is really the importance of an adaptive management process. It is really critical to have a clear and defined process for changing the program over time. We actually reach out annually to a broad list of stakeholders, including our implementation partners, the permittees, academics, a whole bunch of different folks, and pointedly ask them, is there anything we should know? What have you learned in the last year from using the program? Have there been monitoring findings, research findings? What is the relevant information to this program that we should be aware of? And we compile that information in a synthesis document, and then we meet with our board, our executives, and interested parties to have a conversation about what the information is telling us and make some informed decisions about how we do or do not need to change the program. This allows our partners to not only feel heard, but again gives them a sense of where we're going. Again, it's that consistency and predictability piece that they can see where the program is going. So having an incorporated adaptive management process is really important. So really this stuff is extraordinarily complicated, but at the end of the day, it's all about partnerships and trust. I've spent a lot of time working in the Tahoe Basin and have worked very hard to gain the trust and partnership of the folks that we asked to implement this. And without that trust and without that partnership, we wouldn't be anywhere. If you do have that trust, if you have folks working with you on a shared goal, almost anything is possible. You can put together an entire system based on a whole bunch of uncertainty, and folks will come along because they trust where we're going and they trust what's happening. My last slide here is really the bottom line, right? Are we making a difference? Are we actually seeing the improvements? Is the system moving us in the direction we like to see? If you looked at this chart 5 years ago, that line would be straight. We were seeing a steady decline in Lake Tahoe's clarity on the order of about 40 a year. As you see now, that line is curved. The clarity data are encouraging in that what it is showing is that the decline of Lake Tahoe's clarity is likely leveled off, perhaps even halted. And this is exciting to us. Again, it's only 5 years in. I want to caution that there's a bunch of uncertainty here, but we're seeing initial data that suggests that some of the investment and some of the improvement that we're doing is working, and we're hopeful that in coming years we'll actually see that line start to turn down and we'll start the restoration of Lake Tahoe's clarity. So I thank you again very much for your time, and I'm available to answer any questions, as is Dr. Horn. Thank you.
Thank you very much for traveling here to be with us and sharing that. Do any board members have questions or comments?
Madam Chair, thank you. Thank you very much for incredibly informative and broad presentation. Very much appreciated. A couple questions. A lot of focus on existing roads, a lot of focus on how to manage these roads. Are there new roads being considered in the basin? And how do you deal with new developments and construction sites that are only going to expand the challenges that you've identified?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, we are fortunate in the Tahoe Basin that essentially development is capped. The Tahoe Regional Planning Agency was established by an act of Congress in the late 60s and early 70s. Essentially establish a regional planning entity in Lake Tahoe to manage development. And so we've incorporated into our basin plan some of those fundamental elements of development caps. The big one being there's no additional subdivision in the Lake Tahoe Basin. There are a number of vacant parcels, there's infill development, but the new development in Lake Tahoe is essentially not happening. Most of what we see is redevelopment. Mm-hmm. Along those lines, there are essentially no new roads. We're not seeing an expansion of our transportation system. And that's a combination of the prohibitions that are incorporated into our basin plan that are based in the regional plan that was established by the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency.
Perfect, thank you. And then the second part of my question has to do with equity, since I'll use your word.
Yes.
TRPA involves both California and Nevada, doesn't it?
It does.
But we heard the California side of the story and the tremendous things they're doing. Is California carrying the entire load for this action? What's the Nevada role in this, and are they equally engaged and involved as you are?
Yeah, we actually constructed a wall down the Nevada state line.
I saw that.
extraordinarily effective for us in protecting our work.
The navigation has to be well.
He's joking.
It's an underwater wall.
Oh, okay, good. So you get it. Good.
No, it's a fantastic question, and I gave short shrift to Nevada, and they've been with us every step along the way. Our TMDL is a bi-state TMDL. The TMDL that we adopted in California was also adopted in Nevada, essentially the same exact document. The crediting program, everything that we've been discussing this morning, is implemented in Nevada with the exact same protocols and the exact same approach. The key difference in Nevada, the key difference between California and Nevada regulatory structures is they do not have an NPDES permit. So it is not a permitted mandate for them. They do it through what they call interlocal agreements. So they use the threat of permitting to get their to accomplish their goals, as opposed to mandating it within a permit. So, and the pros and cons on this, right? The again, I have no doubt you have great experience with the municipal MPDS program and the nuances within it. There are a lot of detailed requirements and specific elements of permitting that are set by the Clean Water Act. There are things we have to do in our permit that we don't necessarily need or aren't really that important in Lake Tahoe. We've been able to find a nice balance within our permit of that, and we've been working closely with EPA over the last decade on that, and I think we've found a really nice middle ground. But in Nevada, they get to just focus. They get to just focus on the Lake Clarity Crediting Program and focus their municipalities on accomplishing that goal. So they have that benefit. Again, we have a little bit of a stronger hammer in California, so that gives some more motivation on our side of the state line. But in Nevada, they are implementing the program in exactly the same mechanism. So they have credit targets. They have Washoe County, Douglas County are the two jurisdictions that are dealt with on that side, along with the Nevada Department of Transportation. So very analogous, just some slight differences in their regulatory approach.
Other board member questions or comments?
Thanks. Thank you. Just a simply outstanding presentation. Thank you. Question, you had, we started down the world of fine sediment particles and FSPs in orders of magnitude of 10 to the 20 something. And then you said, well, to make it more tangible to the public or the people, we went to credits. So one credit is 10 to the 16th FSPs. Can you tell me what's the mass of a credit?
Yeah.
Just to make it a little bit more tangible to me, are we talking kilograms or metric tons?
Yeah, no, great thing. We used to travel around with this great box, and we used to kind of lift it around. A credit is essentially equal to about 200 pounds of toner cartridge dust material.
Okay.
So roughly 1.5 to 2 feet cubed. If you pack it in, a couple hundred pounds.
Great.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. And we talk. It's again hindsight being 2020, right? I would like to see a TMDL that is in mass because it is much more approachable and understandable. The way the Clarity model works, it actually looks at particles in suspension, and so that's kind of where we landed in this world.
Right,
so
right.
We have a series of conversion factors. Everything, all the models, everything is working in mass. The entire world works in mass.
Well,
we just multiply that by a conversion factor and put it in particles for us.
Well,
and then we multiply it back into credits.
Right. We're familiar with working with turbidity and working,
yeah.
Linking turbidity to suspended sediment concentration, and then that goes to a mass, and then
yeah.
I know it's a very sensitive water body, so it's going to respond to very little inputs, and if we start comparing what we get here for our typical sediment yields is going to be it's going to be apples and oranges to what's happening there. So I was just trying to wrap my brain around it a little bit more. But in terms of how you have it structured, though, and how the program is working, irrespective of what mass and volume are, it's a great model, and I think that there's a lot of things that we can and we see on our horizon where we're going to draw from this as an experience or as an example. So thanks for sharing that with us.
Yeah, thank you. With respect to turbidity, I appreciate that comment, and that a lot of what we're doing now actually is relating fine sediment particle numbers and mass to turbidity. Turbidity is a fantastically cheap and readily available measurement tool. So we have an existing monitoring program. Putting continuous turbidity monitors in place is a no-brainer. And so we're able to actually equate those turbidity measurements now to fine sediment particles so we can start to use that monitoring tool. With respect to your second comment, we spent some time both yesterday evening as well as this morning with your staff. You guys are already in a great place, from what we can tell. Everything that we're saying is consistent and aligned with the type of programs that are in place. So it's comforting, and it's also encouraging to see that a lot of these same ideas are already being implemented and are kind of targeted within your watersheds as well.
Thanks. And to throw the compliment back, to see something that is implemented and working, so we have an example that's being successful, that helps, where it's outside of our region, we can draw on that. So that's learning from your little landmines and pitfalls along the way, and it just makes it a stronger process.
We couldn't have given this presentation in February, right? So I've been working on this for a very long time, and I've always had this niggling concern, like, we need to make sure it's working. and actually this last compliance date was really a good hurdle for us, because we're actually able to demonstrate that it does work, that there's progress. We're getting adoption and acceptance of the program moving forward that is really, really gratifying.
When we adopted the first permit in 2011, the entire board of El Dorado County Supervisors stood up and protested. Mm-hmm. And this time, when we did the renewal, there were no supervisors there, and the staff from El Dorado County just gave supportive comments. So it's a huge turnaround, in large part because of all of the collaborative work with developing partners and adaptive management, and, you know, learning together that has gone on at the staff level along the way.
Thank you very much.
Other board member comments or questions? Okay, well, thank you again. We'll move to, I don't see any comment cards.
There are none.
Would you
like to have a comment card, but I'd like to say something.
So then we'll move to.
Okay, I'll fill out one later. You can go ahead and talk. We'll fill out a speaking card later.
Okay. Hi, my name's Alan Levine. I'm director of Coast Action Group, and the reason why I want to comment is that Coast Action Group and myself have been involved with PNDL since the very beginning, 1995. I think some of you know this, some of you don't, and I wanted to put that out there, and we're highly invested in making PNDLs work, and I'm really affected by this presentation, and I think you are too, because they've taken on something really big to protect a magnificent resource, and they're doing a really good job. And for me, the North Coast Rivers are another magnificent resource, and we've been working on some approved TMDLs, and there's some EPA TMDLs. And I saw recognition from the board regarding the successes and how they are implementing their TMDL that is slightly different than what we're doing here. I think that there's some problems, and that's why I'm here today. That's why I came. I wanted to talk to some people about TMDLs, and this just happened to be happening. I think we're missing targets and implementation schedules and the adoptions of the implementing programs and an assessment process of success is also for adaptive management is also part of the picture that we are not employing. And I think we can all learn from what Tahoe is doing and apply it here. And that's what I'm looking for. And actually, I think that there should be a lot more thinking about where we're going and how we can make these more effective and make them work, because we don't want to be putting all this effort into the process and not seeing results. And I want to get to a place where we can see improvement, where I feel where that improvement has been lacking. So I want to thank you for your time, and we'll see how this goes. Thanks.
Thanks for those comments. Do we have anybody else wishing to comment? Okay, well, before we move to the next item, we will take a 10-minute break, coming back at 10:35.